Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's returning guest is Sean Hogan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Now, we're here to talk about your new long short feature, To Fire You Come At Last, a 17th century story, which we'll go into in a second, but also three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. It's a very narrow band of three films, but I'm enjoying the selection. There's a couple I've seen, and I really like them, so I'm excited to talk about them. But first off, let's talk about your new movie.
It's a period folk horror movie. It was very much intended to be in the sort of great tradition of British ghost stories, this kind of supernatural TV of the 1970s and early 80s. You know, the ghost stories for Christmas, the various supernatural plays for today. So it's very much a kind of tribute to that tradition.
Yeah.
And you know, it's basically a story of four guys carrying a coffin along what they used to call corpse roads, which were roads linking sort of far flung country villages with the local churchyards. And there is a lot of superstition that surrounds these roads, legends and folklore, and the film sort of examines some of that and is kind of like a little character piece about these four guys carrying this coffin.
Yeah, it certainly plays on that thing of the mystery of the dark, and how, I guess, once electricity came along, a lot of the mysteries of the world were solved, weren't they?
One of the things that always really annoys me in films is when you have scenes at night and you can see everything and it's overlit. That's just a pet hate of mine. Yeah. And so with this, it was always one of my kind of touchstones that I was like, look, I just want it really dark. I want this little pool of light where these guys have got their lanterns, and I want everything else to fall off into complete blackness. I want them completely isolated in the darkness, because that's what it's like in the countryside. I mean, yeah. We were filming up in Shropshire in the middle of nowhere. We were like staying in this farmhouse, which was in this valley, and there was like nothing around it. And you go outside the door, the front door of the house, it takes five or six steps, and you wouldn't have to see anything. And that's what darkness looks like in the countryside. And so that was what I wanted to get on film.
Fantastic. Well, look, I'm interested with folk horror. Obviously, Britain is rich with folklore and myth, certainly to do with the period that your film's set in. Is there any particular folklores or myths that you're drawing on for this story?
Yeah, totally. This sort of goes back a little way with me. I stumbled across some of the folklore about Corpse Roads probably about 10 or so years ago.
Okay.
I forget how I came across it, but I started reading about Corpse Roads and some of the folklore associated with him. And I thought, this is really fascinating, and I can't believe no one's actually done this.
Okay.
I was like, it was just sort of like I'd never seen anything dealing with that particular kind of folklore.
Yeah.
And still haven't, really. So So, you know, at the time I was like, well, I've got to use this. Yeah. So I actually wrote a screenplay, a feature screenplay back then called The Corpse Road,
mm-hmm.
Which has nothing to do with this film whatsoever.
Mm.
But I wrote it as a feature screenplay, sort of tried touting that about a bit. It never went anywhere. There was a bit of interest, but never actually went anywhere. In the end, I turned that into a novel during lockdown.
Okay.
Which should hopefully be coming out next year.
Oh, that's exciting.
So all of a sudden, and now having made this film, all of a sudden I'm like, I'm the Corpse Road guy. It's like I've carved out this little niche myself. Which was completely unintentional, but I'm like, well, no one else has done it, so I may as well do it.
Well, this is interesting. I spoke to a Manchester writer who was billed as the King of Manc Noir, and I said, how'd you get that title? Because I was the first one to write a Manc Noir book. So you could be King of the Corpse Road, myth.
Well, the thing is, it was like, so my friend Kayla Janice, who I believe has been on your fine podcast.
Yes.
She was the one who commissioned me to make this film. She's the executive producer.
Right.
And when she approached me, when she sent me a brief, she basically just wanted to do something that dealt in some way with like ritual belief, you know, and she mentioned Corpse Roads as just one example. And I saw it and I thought, well, I can't do that because I've already written this book, which was a script before that.
Oh, hold on a second. So she mentions this without knowing that you've already gone down that road.
Yes. And I literally replied to her saying, I've just written a novel called The Corpse Road, ha ha, so I probably can't do that again.
Yeah.
But then this idea popped, because like I said, the novel is something completely different, and it's contemporary, it's not period.
Yeah.
It does deal to some extent with A Corpse Road, but it's also about a lot of other things.
Okay.
So I kind of thought, well, I could do Corpse Roads because I could dig in more into the actual mythology of them at the time, rather than it sort of being a facet of the novel. And so this kind of idea popped into my head, and I actually wrote something else first, which had nothing to do with Corpse Roads. I wrote another, and it was a conventional short script, which was originally what she asked for. It was like, you know, it was only like 15, 20 pages long.
Mm.
And it dealt with something else entirely. And I finished it and I thought, you know, I don't think she's going to go for this. I'm going to write this other Corpse Road idea, which I sort of sat down and did and didn't really have any idea. I sort of knew what the starting situation was, but I didn't know where it was going to go. I just sat down and started writing to find out who these characters were. And it just kind of unfurled from there. And so I sent, when I finished that, and that turned out to be a lot longer.
Mm.
So In the end, I sent them both to her and I said, look, I've written both of these scripts. One's the short film that you originally asked for. The other one is much longer, but see what you think. And she came back and she was like, I love the longer one. I want to do that one.
Oh, fantastic.
And I was like, well, then we need to.
You mentioned in Kayla that what I should add is, To Fire You Come At Last is currently, I mean, we're talking hot off the heels of it playing at Fright Fest, and it's on its journey now through various festivals. We'll put links in the show notes to say where it's playing next. But it's part of a bigger project that's been done by Severin Films, isn't it? The film. So can you talk about where it fits in a bigger project?
Well, nothing's been announced yet, so I can't really talk about it. But yes, it's part of something Severin will be putting out early next year, and it's, you know, an original piece of work commissioned for that. Basically.
Yeah. Sort of, we can say it's in the folk horror realm, isn't it? They're sort of picking up on work that Kayla's already done with the Woodlands documentary.
Yes, yeah. I was specifically commissioned to make a folk horror piece. Yes.
Fantastic. I mean, that's, you know, it's a wonderful place. I mean, that documentary that Kayla did is amazing. The whole box set that came out of that documentary is truly amazing. I wish I could get my hands on a copy. But it must feel quite exciting to be part of, you know, doing something new with what essentially is a lot of old archives.
Yeah, in a weird way, it's kind of come full circle because I know when Kayla was sort of doing press for her documentary, she mentioned a couple of times that one of the starting points for it was when she stayed with me in London years ago, and she said, show me something I haven't seen before. And, you know, Kayla's seen everything. So I was like, what the fuck am I going to show you that you haven't seen before? And then it suddenly hit me and I was like, oh, have you seen the BBC Christmas Ghost Stories? And she's like, no, I never have. Because at that point, they weren't really available.
Yeah,
I had some sort of, grey market copies, but they weren't really available. So I showed them to her and she loved them. And she says that was one of the starting points for her interest in folk horror.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So now me doing this in that tradition has kind of brought the whole thing full circle, which is really nice. I have to say that kind of it feels like the completion of something.
Now, I spoke to one of your producers, a mutual friend of ours and past guest. He did some Turkish exploitation movies on the podcast, Evrim Asoy. And he asked me to prompt you to talk us through the production process and the difficulties of shooting in such a remote location.
I mean, you know, well, without going on too much about it, when I sat down to write this, I just wrote it because I had the idea. I was kind of seized by the idea.
Mm.
And when it became clear that it was going to happen and what sort of budget it was going to happen, I was suddenly kind of hit by remorse. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done? We've got to make this for this amount of money. And I remember sending it to Evrim and he was like, What have you sent me? What have you written? This is all outdoors. It's all at night. and we're going to have to shoot in March. So I really did make a rod for my own back. And it was kind of like the running gag on set was, next time, Sean, exterior Caribbean day. we shot it in 5 days, which was no time at all. So we had this really, really intense shooting schedule. Mm. Because we had a very tight deadline on it, we had to shoot in March. So the weather was not ideal, shall we say.
Yeah.
There was constant wind. There was intermittent heavy rain. You know, it was muddy. It was cold. We were lucky in that we had this sort of farmhouse, which was our production base, and we shot most of the film within like 15 minutes walk of the house. So we were lucky in that regard.
Yeah.
But even that was hard work. And there was one day where we went up to this sort of rock formation to shoot up there.
Mm.
And that was literally just, you know, the rain was coming at us sideways. There were like people falling down muddy hills, carrying camera equipment. It was just, it was the hardest shoot I've ever done easily.
Oh, really?
Yeah, easily. I mean, low-budget shoots, they're always hard work. You're always rushing to get stuff done.
Mm.
But in the past, I've been sensible enough to write low-budget films that were mostly set indoors. I was like, right, no, now I'm going to go outside. And it taught me never to go outside, you know. It was incredibly hard work. I couldn't have, the crew I made it with, the core team are basically old friends of mine. I was at college with them 30 years ago.
Right.
I could not have done it without them because they just worked so hard and were so tireless. And, you know, the actors as well. I knew one of the actors, James Swanson, who plays Ransley, I'd worked with before.
Right.
But the other guys I didn't know at all. And, you know, it's the sort of thing where the cast could have said, fuck this. Oh, this is, I was paid enough for this.
I was going to say, when obviously you're not daft. Obviously, you can sense. You say yourself, it's one of the difficult shoots you've done, so you know it's a challenge. Even compared to just doing a shoot, you know, it's a 42-minute film. 5 days is not a lot of time to shoot a 42-minute movie. So, what conversations are you having? I mean, are you having conversations? Or everyone just ignoring the elephant in the room that the weather's terrible and we just got to get through it.
I mean, I was very open up front. When I went to all the actors, I sort of said, look, this is going to be tough. We're not going to have much time. We're not going to have much money. We're outdoors in March. It's going to be tough. So please don't accept the role if you're not up for it. And I actually did have, there was one other actor that I offered a part to who, again, I know and have worked with before.
Yeah.
And I gave him this spiel and he was like, I don't think I'm up for that. And he basically turned it down without reading the script. He has since expressed much regret to me that he did this, but you know, I think he would have, you know, it was basically everything I said it was going to be. So I think he probably would have had a hard time if he'd have said yes. So maybe it worked out.
To go to such lengths with that kind of location, you did shoot on a corpse road then?
No, we didn't. I did originally look at doing that because there are still a few existing, because a lot of them are just lost to time.
Of course.
A few where we still know that they were used as corpse roads. Mm. And so originally I was looking at that, but it was just going to be so difficult logistically to sort of shoot out in the middle of nowhere that when the opportunity came up for us to shoot at this site in Shropshire where we would have the use of this farmhouse, I just thought that's going to like save us so much time and money
because
we have not got a lot of money we can throw at this.
Sure.
So, we went up and recce'd it and I just found all everything we needed. So it was like, you know, it doesn't matter that it's not an actual corpse road because as I say, most of them are lost to time.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah. Yeah. So. It felt like one. It felt like one when you watch it. One last question. I mean, like Robert Eggers, The Witch, you have a lot of fun with the language of the time that your film is set in. And you know, lots of unusual turns of phrase, occasional words I've never heard of. I mean, I'm interested in writing such an authentic voice for the time and sort of resources that you would use to keep yourself in line. Because obviously none of us can know, you know, instinctively 17th century.
Well, of course
English.
Not. And you know, and I don't pretend that it's, you know, that accurate. I mean, Robert Eggers is somewhat more fastidious about it than I am.
Mm.
I know he sort of goes back into like, you know, period diaries and all this kind of thing. You know, that's great and it works for him. I would much rather just sort of try and write in an idiom that sounds period appropriate for the most part.
Yeah.
The one thing I do and I do enjoy doing is researching period slang and period phrases and just kind of putting them in like spice. So some of the words that you're referring to that you've never heard before, and that's probably where those kind of words come from. You know, there's shabaroon is a good one that I found, and I was like, I'm having that, I'm using that.
And what does shabaroon mean?
Shabaroon just means a fool, an idiot, you know.
Oh, fantastic.
But it's just stuff like that where it's just like, that's yeah, it just gives you that period flavor.
Yeah.
You know, and the rest of it is, you know, it's a very kind of heightened style of dialogue, but it's really fun to write that way as long as you've got actors that can handle it. It gestures at being period appropriate, but as I say, I wasn't too anal about getting all the specifics, you know, spot on.
It should
sound right, hopefully.
An aspect of it that really stands out when people get to see it is the you've got your four characters, and what's interesting is there's this wonderful hierarchy. There's somebody at the bottom, there's somebody second from the bottom, there's someone second from the top, and there's someone at the top. And that drives this kind of wonderful, almost, I mean, not comedic in a ha-ha hilarious sense, but almost a comedic rivalry that sort of...
Yeah, I mean, I hope there is, you know, comedy in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was nice watching it at Fright Fest. It was the first time I've watched it with an English language audience.
Right.
It premiered in Korea, but obviously that's a little different.
Yeah.
But watching it at Fright Fest, you know, I was really glad to see it was getting laughs in certain places, which are meant to be comedic. One of my original notes to myself when I was thinking about it was, I want it to be like as if Martin McDonagh made a horror movie. I want that kind of black comedy mixed with violence and more serious stuff.
I can see that.
Yeah. So, you know, yes, I hope some of it is funny. And the hierarchy stuff, absolutely deliberate. You know, that's it's not, the film is not about politics per se, but it was kind of impossible for me not to have that aspect to it.
No, you've kind of given yourself a vehicle to make the point without needing to be too on the nose about it. It just is part of the chemistry, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's all, you know, and it's all about the power struggles between the four guys and how, you know, the guy with all the power is not necessarily the most powerful one, and how the guy with no power whatsoever tries to play power games with other people and set them against each other. So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that's really fun to write about it. Yeah, it's just, it's not just the horror movie. It's those kind of character dynamics and the actual drama of it, the power plays between them all.
That's a film you've made with Severin. There'll be announcements in 2024, I imagine, about what that's part of, to do with their folk horror stuff. It's going to play at festivals. They'll be announced as and when they are secured and stuff. And I'll put a link in the show notes to let people know where it's at. And let us move into some weird and eerie TV. I think that's a safe description of what we're about to talk about. I mean, essentially, I think going to the English countryside has never been scarier than the three films that you've highlighted for us.
We would maintain that there's no place scarier than the English countryside.
Till I saw Killer's documentary, I hadn't thought about the English attitude to folk horror and folk legend compared to our European cousins or our further afield cousins who have a kind of symbiotic relationship with nature where we just think we've got to control it, harness it, or kill it. You know, so the minute we enter it, we go, it's going to get us because it knows what we've done. So we've got three films. And so for those people that don't know the formula, it's very simple. I've got three titles that Sean has shared with me. We're going to speak for 5 minutes about each one. When the alarm goes off at the end of 5 minutes, we will stop talking. You can obviously finish your thought and we'll move on to the next one. That sound all right to you, Sean?
Sounds good.
First out the gate is 1972's A Warning of the Curious, a ghost story by M.R. James, adapted for the second installment of Ghost Story for Christmas by Lawrence Gordon Clark, who did The Stalls of Barchester, which is one of my favourites of the ghost.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Very serious.
Right.
Do you want to talk to us about what it is for you, this one, A Warning to the Curious?
Just to sort of say up front that I wanted to talk about these three things purely because of how they relate to the film I've just made, For You Come at Last, that kind of 70s British supernatural TV tradition. So these, and some of these were very formative in terms of how I approach that film, some less so, but I think they're all really standout examples of that form.
Yeah.
So Warning to the Curious as you said, is the second of the official Christmas ghost stories by Lawrence Gordon Clark. It, in terms of its influence for me, you know, Lawrence Gordon Clark, I think, is still really underrated as a British horror director because he worked in television.
Okay.
I think he's actually like one of the real standout genre craftsmen we ever had. You look at those films he did, the ghost stories,
yeah,
they're really like exquisitely made and they're very cinematic despite being made for TV. And they were made on relatively limited budgets.
Mm.
But what distinguishes them, I think, or one of the things that distinguishes them, is he has a real eye for landscape and setting. And he used to go out and basically location scout these things himself. He would go out and find interesting locations,
okay,
you know, the right parts of the country to go and film these things in. And these films really capture that. They will capture a sense of place. And they're so evocative in terms of like the eeriness of the English landscape.
Mm.
And The Warning to Curious does this beautifully. It's a coastal story set on the seaside in Norfolk. And it really just captures that really odd liminality of the British coastline. Mm. And just seeing these films, you know, when I, because like they were sort of unavailable for years, and I then eventually started to catch up with them. I think they started repeating them on BBC4 several years ago, and I started seeing them then, and they just really sort of struck me that how simple they are. It's, you know, there's not much in the way of special effects or anything like that, but they're really so amazingly eerie and atmospheric.
Yeah.
And that was something that I was really sort of striving for in my film, was again that sort of sense of the countryside, the sense of landscape, and, you know, trying to capture this kind of mood of dread and strangeness with very limited means, you know. And these Lawrence Gordon Clark's films are really kind of a how-to guide in how you approach that. I think they're really kind of a model of economical directing.
I mean, the ones where there is a lot more interior stuff, which we'll talk about certainly with The Exorcism, is a lot more talky, but certainly this one into the curious and ones where they are going outside and there's a lot more attention to the landscape. There isn't the talkiness of what you associate with TV. It's allowed to breathe, which is, I mean, was the BBC commissioners on drugs in the 70s? Because how the hell, you know, it feels like a foreign country that was making this type of TV compared to now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously the standard at the time was that you would shoot exteriors on film, and then the interiors you would go into the studio and they would be shot on videotape, which is why you now look back at these things, and to modern eyes they look quite strange because there's clash between the two formats. That was actually something I thought about possibly doing with mine, and then I just thought anyone who isn't familiar with what that is just going to think that's really weird, so I didn't go down that road. But for whatever reason, Lawrence Gordon Clark was allowed to go out and shoot on location.
Mm.
You know, they were all shot on film, they're all shot on location, and it just gives them a feeling that a lot of other BBC drama of the time doesn't have. And it's one of those things that helps them feel like mini movies rather than,
without a doubt, TV plays.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know whether it was just because the budgets were so small that he was allowed to do what he wanted. It didn't come under the purview of the BBC drama department initially. I know that because he was part of the documentary department.
Oh, my word.
And so he kind of slipped it in under the radar. All right, that's me done.
It is. That's the alarm. It's amazing. I must admit, I got the BFI box set when it was available, the DVDs, and it's not something, it was just something that, in a way, I'd seen clips thanks to the way YouTube was evolving, but I'd not seen like whole ones. When you watch them, certainly like the one he did for the Stalls of Barchester and stuff, it's a really moody piece. Like
I would say, and not just because I have commentaries on them, the Blu-ray upgrades are really worth getting.
Okay.
They're really remastered beautifully, because those DVDs were a bit unmastered. They're a bit ragged.
Oh, okay.
But the Blu-rays look really beautiful. So
no, it feels like there was a halcyon moment or two for British TV with this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we can get the whole 70s, you know, the fact that Supernatural TV is basically verboten now unless Mark Gatiss is doing it.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the fact that, you know, every time you looked around on TV in the 70s, there was something else, supernatural horror being produced, you know, in otherwise sort of relatively highbrow strands like Play for Today or whatever else, you would still get works of, you know, genre television. You know, it's just a different time, as they say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think, well, you mentioned yourself, the Ghost Stories for Christmas are a joy to get hold of. And so that, and I didn't realize there was the Blu-ray. So yeah, I'll put links in the show notes to that. Jumping to another anthology series, the short-lived, I think, only think it did one, Dead of Night, Don Taylor's wonderful The Exorcism, which is sort of play for today on acid, as far as I'm concerned. But you can tell us more.
So The Exorcism, again, is like classic folk horror. It's, you know, it's a story of the terrible city folk coming to the countryside and stirring up ancient forces they don't understand.
The silly buggers.
It's also, yes, and wearing dreadful, dreadful 70s clothes while they're doing it. It's also explicitly, nakedly political. You know, it is shot through with class politics. It's a remarkably angry piece, actually. You know, possibly a tad unsubtle in places, but the fact that this, you know, it's angry, and it's also quite horrific and quite frightening.
It pulls no punches,
does it? No, it really doesn't. I don't think it went out at Christmas. I believe it went out around Bonfire Night.
Yeah, it was a November. It was a November series. Yeah. It was a November series. Yeah.
Yes, but it's a Christmas story, nonetheless. And the idea that anyone would sit down and watch this thing on Christmas, because it's so bleak and it's so unsparing, and it is very much more in the tradition we were talking about of the TV play. And it has been done for theatres where you can easily sort of see it being done as a play. Apart from a few exterior shots, it is all very much in the one set.
Yeah.
And that was something that was kind of my film sort of nods in that tradition slightly, and that it is very dialogue driven, more so than, say, Warning to the Curious, which was almost like a silent film at times.
Indeed.
You know, The Exorcism is very much a play for television. And I wanted to capture something of that. I mean, hopefully mine's a bit of a hybrid, because I was concerned with the visuals as well. And I think some of it is very visually driven. But I do like that sort of tradition of kind of dialogue TV drama as well. And this has some beautiful writing in it, and especially the sort of climactic monologue where you discover exactly what the cause of this haunting is and what's happened. And it's sort of like this beautiful monologue delivered by Anna Cropper, which is just a fantastic piece of acting. And so, yeah, and it's also because it's, you know, the class politics as well. Again, I sort of said that, you know, mine is not specifically about that. It's more a byproduct of that. But that was kind of something of The Exorcism that creeped into mine, sort of that sense of politics and underlying the ghost story. That was definitely something I wanted to sort of try and capture as well.
And what do you think in, I mean the idea of, I mean, this I'm trying to think now, what year is Exorcist now? 73.
The Exorcist.
Yeah,
73.
So
yeah,
we're predating the release of The Exorcist with this wild play, really, on television. When I first saw it, my first thought was like, you know, I'd love to get just be sat there in somebody's living room in 1972 just to see what the reaction was to this wild TV show.
You just kind of think, would this ever be commissioned now? And the answer is no. It's, you know, we're lucky if we get like a Christmas ghost story every year. And I think at this point, they have sort of passed into a certain coziness, which the older ones still don't have for me. They've still got like they kind of pack a punch and they're still eerie. The new ones feel like it's more of a tradition now, and they're slightly cozy. They're not making you sit up and go, what the hell have I just watched? You know, and I think The Exorcism still has the power to do that, you know, and I would like to see more, you know, genre TV. Well, I'd like to see more genre TV full stop, but also that packs that kind of power.
Well, I guess as well, I think what we're seeing now is sort of tinged with nostalgia, whereas, like you say, something like The Exorcism that Don Taylor's written as well as directed, is he's letting his emotions go, isn't he? He's angry about something and he's going to put it in his program.
And that's, you know, it's the great thing about genre is that you can use horror and do that. You can sort of smuggle this stuff in underneath the scares. And that's one of the great things about working in horror.
And even when it's made for in a studio like it is, you think of the TVs that people that were expected to watch this on. You know, you weren't going to get a visual treat, were you? In terms of
no, yeah.
In terms of what you would have saw this program
kind of stuff, like, you know, looks probably much worse to us now than it did at the time because we're watching it in high def, and you know.
But yeah, no, just thinking about, you know, the TVs you would have, the UHV TVs you would have watched it on. You know, it's like the cathode rays as opposed to the HDs and the 4Ks and whatever, you know, the Blu-rays.
Certainly the video stuff that was shot in the studio, there's only so good that's going to look. You know, the film, as I say, with the Blu-rays of the Ghost Stories, Christmas Ghost Stories, BFI have done a wonderful job. They look lovely, but they were shot on film. So there's a bit more scope there to upgrade them. But yeah.
Indeed. For your final selection, we're going to 1976, story called Baby, which was part of Nigel Neill's anthology series Beasts, something I've not seen. And now that I know about it, I will be watching it after this conversation, directed by John Nelson Burton. Do you want to talk about its influence on you? What's so important about this? And I'm guessing it's about making sure Nigel Neill gets a shout out, if nothing else.
Yeah. So this wasn't too much of a direct influence on the film I've just made. But it didn't feel right to sort of do a list of TV folk horror and not have Nigel Neill in here. And you know, I think this is a really important piece of work otherwise.
Yeah.
So I wanted to include it. I mean, Nigel Neill did, you know, a number of works which are of, you know, great importance within the sort of folk horror subgenre. Not only this, but the Stone Tape. He did a TV play called Moraine, which is also very good. Even like some of the Quatermath films have some degree of folk horror in them. So, you know, he worked in this kind of register a lot. But Baby, again, is this sort of very much a TV play. It has a bit more, it's not quite as interior as The Exorcism. It has a bit, uses exteriors a bit more, but a lot of it is confined within a farmhouse. And it's basically about, again, a city couple moving to the countryside, and they find something dreadful within one of the walls of this old farmhouse they're renovating. And it's very much, again, about the sort of past coming back to infect the present, which is sort of like a classic folk horror trope.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Baby's just so kind of beautifully horrible. And it has this real sense of just creeping dread to it. I mean, as I say, it didn't have too much of a direct influence on this. But it is very much about kind of toxic masculinity, and the way it sort of oppresses women. And although there aren't any women in my film, you've definitely got a very bunch of very toxic men.
So, yeah.
And that's kind of something you see in this era of TV a lot as well. You see a lot of these kind of supernatural one-off plays are very much about the patriarchy and about, you know, women being oppressed and it's using the supernatural as a metaphor for these kind of things,
yeah.
Which I think Baby does really well.
What is it? What do you think? I mean, Nigel Neill spans decades with his work, even at this point in 76. What you as a fan of folk horror and you know, all the orbits that, what do you think it is that he gets so right about this idea of it's like the old Bible thing, you know, the sins of the father and that, but actually we're all doomed by the sins of everybody's father from the, you know, as far as the present goes.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of living, what comes of living in a country that has a lot of history.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like other younger countries don't necessarily have that, but we have a lot of history. We may not have much else, but we've got a lot of history. I think Nigel Neill was sort of responding to that. I mean, he was also someone, again, who was who was a big fan of M.R. James.
Okay, okay.
So he may well have been influenced by the sort of folk horror aspects of James. You know, and again, it's sort of like, because folk horror is now, you know, in the last sort of 10, 15 years, become sort of much more codified and recognized as this subgenre.
Yeah.
But the people who were working in it back then didn't know they were working in it, in much the same way that people who, the directors who made what we now call film noir, they had no idea they were making film noir. They were just making crime movies and gangster movies and whatever. It was critics that came along later and said, yeah, ah, but this is, of course, this is film noir.
Yeah.
And I think folk horror is very similar in that regard. It's sort of like, yeah, there's a lot of arguments about what is and what isn't folk horror.
Mm.
And, you know, this is something I've dabbled in occasionally. Kim Newman and I recently recorded a commentary for Witchfinder General where we argued that it isn't folk horror. and, you know, you can have all these sorts of debates about it. But I think, you know, what Nigel Neal does in Baby and several of his other works is absolutely, inarguably folk horror.
Mm.
You know, he gets at the core of it. It's about ancient folklore that, you know, that's been buried and forgotten in the past, but has now been revealed, you know, through the forces of modernity have revealed this stuff and it's going to come back and get us.
Yeah, because in a way,
to me, is a core is a folk horror theme.
Yeah, because in a younger country like America, you've got Carolyn Glover's idea of urbanoia, which is obviously the fear of going to the countryside and those people that live there. Those people that live there are going to get you. Whereas for us, it's literally the journey back to where we've all come from. You know, we all started out in the countryside, hundreds of thousands of years, wherever you want to start it from. And we made cities. So we basically vacated we left the countryside bounds. It was like, there's a sense of like, without getting too convoluted about like it's like, you know, we are defined by our past. Our past is not exactly precise because it is so old. Yes. And therefore,
yeah,
there's a sense you can prick into it like Nigel Neal does and sort of go, yeah, there's a lot of grief in this soil and it'll come back and bite you.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 And you can never, you know, no matter how much you try and pave it over and wipe it away, you can never get rid of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's been absolutely, this has been fun talking about these. These are great nodal points, I think, for British horror, full stop, not just obviously TV horror.
I think it's because of certain issues of availability and a lot of, you know, we're only talking about some of the stuff that's like widely available.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff out there that is not really available. There's a lot of it on YouTube you can find, stuff that doesn't have a commercial release, but you can find on YouTube. There are certain things that aren't even on YouTube that I've never managed to see. There's so much of this stuff out there, and it really is kind of a golden age of British horror, I think, that's not still really not properly understood or properly been examined just because of availability. You know, people sort of like, you say British horror and people think about Hammer or whatever, but like this wave was coming in just as Hammer were dying out. But to me, this is like a really vital, important part of British genre filmmaking that's still kind of not really getting its due.
No, I mean, and to be honest with you, it's like, and I started with the phrase before we began talking about it. I think what they do is they put weird and eerie under the microscope, which I think is I'm not nature's best person. If I go out in the countryside, I feel absolutely lost. Is, you know, me and animals, we're not, you know, I just naturally in the modern day when I've got nothing to fear, it's like you get me too far away from civilization and I am lost. You know, you get me properly away from it. And so I love the idea. I mean, the simple horror in the idea of removing us from our modernity and making us, in a sense, confront our past, even though, you know, we wouldn't be thinking of it. It's there for you. There you look around. It's all there.
Yeah, totally.
Well, look, Sher, Tafai, You Come at Last is going to be doing the rounds at the festivals. I'll put links in the show notes to show where signpost where it is now. There'll be a release with some other gear with Severin Films in 2024 sometime. And again, we'll update it when that news is available. But it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the Britflix podcast.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me. We'll be right back.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.